thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
The Bible reading this morning is from the book of Matthew, which is the first book in the New Testament, chapter 2, verses 1 to 12. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem, and they asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least amongst the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
Thanks, Nicolai. Good morning. Merry Christmas. It's good to see you here. It's nice to see some familiar faces that haven't been around for a while, visiting family or back from overseas or whatever it might be. It's great to have you here this morning. Trust that this start to your Christmas day ends up being kind of just the beginning of a really excellent day with family and friends and wherever you kind of get to. Trust that it's both safe and very merry as well. Our theme for Christmas this year, for those of you who were listening to Jodes earlier or have been around, is this idea that we are not alone. And it actually comes from a song by Christy Knuckles. It was off her 2016 Christmas album, The Thrill of Hope. It's called A Song in the Air. And there are a couple of words in it. I'm not going to sing it, but a couple of words in it that say, "Can you hear it? The song that is calling you home? And do you know it? The love that says you're not alone." When I heard those words, I thought, that sounds like a Christmas theme. That's why I like Christmas music, just as an aside, because I can find new themes for Christmas. This theme, exploring the evidence that we have that in Jesus' coming, God has given us the strongest evidence that we are not alone. In fact, he cares for us and has come to us. But the idea that we are not alone also has a more common cultural connotation, does it not? Quick show of hands, how many of you thought this was about aliens? A few of you, brave enough. I'm not going to ask how many of you hoped it was about aliens. But funnily enough, I'm actually going to talk about aliens, because aliens and Christmas actually kind of, they kind of go together in really sorts of funny kinds of ways. December 16th, 1965, Gemini 6, a manned satellite that NASA had put into space, was about to re-enter when the astronauts contacted Houston and said, "We have an object. Looks like a satellite going from north to south, probably in polar orbit. Looks like he might be going to re-enter soon. I see a command module and 8 smaller modules in front. The pilot of the command module is wearing a red suit." At which point the two astronauts embarked on a rendition of Jingle Bells, complete with a harmonica and a set of bells that they had smuggled aboard. Completed in one fell swoop two things. They'd not only pranked NASA, but they also were the first live musicians ever in space. So how about that? Now you know some more useless trivia that you can share just before you go into your food coma later this afternoon. But that's not all. Fragments of a Russian rocket booster, which disintegrated over the American Southwest just a couple of years ago, led to all sorts of speculation that aliens were arriving just before Christmas, and lest we think that it's only our American friends. Our English friends as well also have some UFO sightings around Christmas. Their most famous UFO sighting happened in 1980 on December 26th through the 28th at Rendlesham Forest. And just last year in Ramsgate, England, some strange lights were filmed just a few days before Christmas, which led to further speculation. Of course, the filming was done on really low-quality cameras. Those seem to be the only type that anyone ever uses. If you have a high-def camera, you're unlikely to see a UFO, right? Because that's not going to produce the wonderful grainy images that lead to so much speculation. Yuletide movies have now picked up the theme. Not that surprising, really, when you think about the delivery of toys around the world, but some sort of faster-than-light thing. And all the radar that we have. So has anyone seen Arthur Christmas? No, you haven't. You can tell the age of people by how many movies they've seen. Now, Arthur Christmas introduced us to S1. It's like this really highly technologically advanced space sleigh, complete with cloaking technology that they kind of fly over the world and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of a cool idea. And even the Christmas story, the biblical Christmas story, has been reimagined as an alien encounter. I heard of Christa Berg. How's this for dating people? 1986, Lady in Red. I'm not going to sing that either. 10 years before that, Christa Berg had released a Christmas song entitled A Spaceman Came Traveling. Here are some of the lyrics. A spaceman came traveling on his ship from afar. 'Twas light years of time since his mission did start. And over a village he halted his craft, and it hung in the sky like a star, just like a star. And on he goes to talk about how the star Bethlehem was actually a spaceship. Spaceman comes out. Everyone freaks out. He goes, don't worry, I'm from a planet far away. Like, that's going to make anyone feel better. Then he sings this beautiful melody, and it's Christmas all over again. And in 2010, Christa Berg did an interview on the BBC with Liam Allen, kind of giving the background of the song. And I stumbled upon it when I was actually looking for the lyrics and kind of came across the background. And it's pretty fascinating, actually. He said that the song was inspired by two literary works. The first was a book published in 1968. It's entitled Chariots of the Gods, published by Erich von Däniken. It has, in its 50 years since publication, sold 70 million copies. In 1971, it received a nomination from the Oscars for Best Documentary. And his thesis was that the technology of the ancients was actually given to them by aliens, but they just didn't know it, and so subscribed it to gods. So the pyramids, the Nazca lines, Stonehenge, all that stuff that we look back and think, how in the world did they do that without help? Well, he said, well, they did have help. It was just aliens who helped them. And this idea, even if you're not familiar with the book, is actually fairly prevalent. You find it popping up in all sorts of sci-fi stuff in lots of different places. Kind of a fascinating concept. And so Christa Berg had taken this and asked the question, what if the Star of Bethlehem was in fact a spacecraft? What if it was actually some sort of alien ship? And off he went to write the song. But there was a second piece of work that he also was influenced by, and it was completely different. It was actually a poem by William Butler Yeats, published in 1919, shortly after World War I. It's entitled The Second Coming, and it's a little darker. Here's the poem. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze as blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Pretty dark, isn't it? And the first thought, you just heard it for the first time, but when I read it, I thought, what's the connection with the spaceship guy? And William Yeats has had a look at the world right after World War I, has looked at all that's gone wrong with the world and has basically despaired and said, you know what, we're due another coming, another second coming, but it's not going to be the benevolent Jesus. Instead, it's going to be some sort of horrible, chaotic, anarchic monster, some sort of sphinx-like shape. And interestingly, Christa Berg actually took the only piece out of it was the 20 centuries piece. He took the 2,000 years as another time for a revelation and applied it to his song. He basically, in the very last stanza of his song, said, just before dawn, at the paling of the sky, the stranger returned and said, now I must fly. When 2,000 of your years have gone by, this song will begin once again to a baby's cry. So there I was preparing a sermon, and I've been sucked down a rabbit hole just like that. It happens to the best of us, right? I just wanted to look for some lyrics, and next thing you know, I'm like citing William Yeats's poetry and thinking about all these kind of bizarre sorts of things. But it's a really interesting combination, isn't it? To take on the one hand this view of the world that says it's all falling apart and there's nothing we can do except face it. And this other, and I'm not sure I want to put Yeats and Christa Berg on the same kind of poetic parallel, but you know, on the other hand, you've got this song that's ultimately a song of hope, that yes, the world's getting bad, and yes, we're close to another revelation, but in reality, there's still hope. Now, unfortunately, the hope that he found was in aliens, but nonetheless, it's hope, isn't it? And this still resonates with us today. Because the Christmas story, I think, actually provides us with a way in which we can kind of handle both of those, right? Because the thing about looking to aliens is it's kind of escapism, isn't it? It's kind of saying that, you know, we're hurtling towards some cliff, right? You don't have to look very hard in the news to see how what we're heading for, do you? The polarization in our national, international political dialogue, the rise of authoritarian and despotic regimes, the degradation of our environment, our wasteful consumption, the reduction of everything and everyone to a mere algorithm to be used for marketing and social propaganda. It goes on and on and on, doesn't it? And we don't have to look very hard, and yet for us to kind of face it as Yeats did and say, basically, you know what, we're just hurtling over the edge, we might as well just grin and bear it, doesn't seem like a very hopeful way forward, does it? But I'm also not particularly comfortable suggesting we just wait for the ships to arrive, because I'm not convinced that that's going to happen. I'm not persuaded that there's alien life, and if there is, I'm not persuaded they're very interested in us either. But the Christmas story actually allows us to look first and foremost at the trouble of our world, but not to just face it and say, well, it's just going to be horrible, so let's just hang on, nor to try to escape it, but actually to find the hope of Jesus. Because the claims that Jesus makes is that he will unpick all the knots that are wrong in our world. This is the big, big story that the Christmas story introduces for us, doesn't it? The hope that we will no longer view each other as numbers or as a means to an end, that we'll actually see the end of prejudice and racism and discrimination and sexual exploitation and slavery and poverty. These are the sorts of things that Jesus claims to bring. We sing about them in our Christmas songs, right? We sing about the fact that Jesus has come to rule the world, to finish sin and death, and those are enormous, enormous claims. But they're claims of hope. And so this story that was read for us, I think, gives us a really interesting insight into what we can begin to do. Because the story that we read, the stories we read at Christmas, such as these wise men, these magi, these kings who come from afar, gives us an example that we can begin to follow. And it's a pretty iconic story, isn't it? I mean, apart from the fact that we sing We Three Kings and we've got wise men grazing, you know, kind of on our nativity sets and on our cards and all of those sorts of things, do you realize that this story is why you have a star on top of your tree? Unless, like us, you bought a tree that was too big for your house and so the top of the tree is just bent at the top, right? We tried, right? But the reason there are stars is this story, right? This is why stars are such a prominent, prevalent symbol for us at Christmas. But it goes beyond that, because these wise men, these foreigners, actually foreshadow the inclusion of all nations into the plans and purposes of God. We believe that the Christmas story introduces a new chapter in the ongoing story of God's plan to restore and renew everything in Christ Jesus. And so these three become a really significant little group. Scholars are in agreement that Matthew, when he was writing his gospel account, was primarily interested and focused on writing about Jesus for the, I guess, for the benefit of Jewish readers. A lot of what he talks about, a lot of the ways he describes and explains Jesus would have made a lot of sense to Jews. And so it's really striking that some of the very first characters we meet are not Jews. And these Jews, these non-Jews, actually end up being an example for us because they see a star, which was evident to everyone. I mean, anyone could have looked up and seen the star, but these individuals had the capacity, the understanding, the curiosity to begin to investigate that. And it's quite an investigation when you think about it. We don't know exactly where they were, how far east they were, but they were far enough away that they probably had to find the prophecies in some other translation and have them translated. They had to make all their calculations. Then they had to make a decision to leave where they lived and go on a journey that brought them to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, I can imagine, they would have been a little bit surprised that no one else had noticed the star, that there were no other search parties out, that no one else was aware, it seemed. And the only people who were kind of mildly interested was Herod, and he was like a despotic authoritarian ruler who had his own sons killed when he thought that they might take the throne. Herod didn't want to worship this child. He just wanted to know where the rival king was. Even the religious leaders, the ones who came to them and answered their question and said, well, the Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem. Even the religious leaders didn't follow them to Bethlehem itself. Did you notice that? These three individuals, not Jewish, with no real background in all of this, had traveled a long way, came to Jerusalem, figured out what was next, and went to Bethlehem by themselves. And when they arrived and they met a peasant couple with a baby, don't you think they would have been tempted to kind of go over their calculations again? Because it wouldn't have been turning out the way they would have thought. It would have been this case of kind of stepping into the house, seeing the baby and the peasant couple, stepping back outside for a moment and just making sure that your math was right and that you had actually carried the one. Because this seemed really strange. And yet, these three individuals, or however many there were, respond with faith. They become the second example of faith in Matthew's gospel. The first is Joseph, who believes what the angel tells him about Mary's pregnancy. But here, these wise men exercise their faith and they pay homage to Jesus and they give him their gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, and then they return home. It's a remarkable story, a remarkable example for each of us. Because ultimately, the story of Jesus requires faith. It really, really does. I want to pretend that it's a simple, easy story. The story that we believe, the story that we talk about, the thing that keeps us going as a church is a really big story that requires a great deal of faith. We believe that a child born 2,000 years ago grew to become a man, died, and that his death was unlike any other, and that he rose again, and that in his ongoing life in heaven at the right hand of the Father, he is going to restore and renew everything and change everyone's life. That's a big deal, isn't it? That's an enormous, enormous thing to put your hope in. But the story requires faith because hope requires faith. See, William Yeats, when he looked at the world and said, it's all going bad, he chose the courageous route of despair, didn't he? To just look it dead in the eye and say, it's going to be ugly, fine. And if you're happy with that courageous stance of despair, knock yourself out. I would prefer hope. And this story invites us to have hope and to believe that there's more to Jesus than perhaps meets the eye. But ultimately, that means the story of the wise men is not a story that is complete in and of itself. It's a story that invites each of us into investigation for ourselves. Earlier this year, as a community of faith, we actually took some time and kind of preached through a whole bunch of Matthew's gospel. And we started our series in chapter 4, just a couple passages on. And Jesus, in that passage, calls some disciples to begin following him. And it's a fascinating story because he basically goes up to these guys who are going to become the apostles, you know, St. Peter and St. Andrew and all that lot. And he comes up to them and asks them or invites them to follow him. And what struck me as so remarkable is that he doesn't ask them whether they believe. And as the story unfolds, it becomes really clear that they don't. They have no idea who Jesus is. On several occasions, they actually ask each other, "Who is this?" Like, they have no idea. And I would have thought that to be a disciple, you would have had to have believed first. And Jesus says, "No, you follow me first. Faith comes later." Secondly, he doesn't ask them. He doesn't give them a pop quiz. He doesn't say, "Okay, boys, I'm looking for disciples, and you look like a pretty likely crew. So just a pop quiz on the law of Moses. You get 5 out of 5, you can follow me. Here we go. You ready?" He doesn't do that. And as the story unfolds, it becomes very evident that they have no idea who Jesus is or how he's the fulfillment of prophecies. It takes them forever to figure it out. And I would have thought that to be a disciple of Jesus would have meant that you had to have some understanding of what he was on about. Apparently not. And third, Jesus makes no demands that they change their behavior. He doesn't tell them, "Listen, you guys are going to have to stop doing some certain things and start acting differently and start being more legalistic and more self-righteous and more hypocritical and all those great things that Christians are known for," right? He says, "You don't have to do any of that." And again, I would have thought that if you were going to follow Jesus, then your life ought to change. And Jesus basically says, "No, follow me." And in the following, understanding comes. And in the following, faith grows. And in the following, the implications of faith comes and lives are changed. But the invitation to follow is open to anyone, regardless of the fears they have, the concerns they have, the doubts they harbor, the questions they have. Isn't that remarkable? And it shouldn't surprise us in chapter 4 that that's how Jesus begins his ministry, because we see that laid out for us with these wise men who saw the star as an invitation to begin to investigate, and along the way grew an understanding that allowed faith to grow and ultimately changed their lives. And the invitation is open to each one of you today. The same invitation. Whether you count yourself as someone who understands Christianity and the claims of Jesus, whether you think, "You know, I have hardly any understanding at all," whether you actually have any space in your life for faith, or whether you think that there's just so many questions, so many obstacles, so many problems, the invitation to begin to explore is still open to you. Even if you fear that you're not up for the changes to your lifestyle that following Jesus may imply, you can begin to investigate it nonetheless. Jodine mentioned in January, we're going to be looking at a series of social issues from the perspective of faith. And we would love for you to begin to explore and explain and investigate the claims of Jesus here. We'd love for you to come back, to begin the conversation, to ask some of your questions, to start following Jesus. It doesn't matter if you don't understand him. It doesn't matter if you don't believe him. It doesn't matter if your life is just a complete wreck or still looks fantastic or whatever. It doesn't really matter. You can begin to follow him. The Christmas story is ultimately an invitation to each of us to explore the hope that we are not alone. And the story that we celebrate and we remember today is one that reminds us and reminds us not only that we're not alone, but also provides us a better place than despair and a more certain hope than aliens. So wherever your hope lies this year, wherever your hope lies this Christmas, whatever you think about the direction of the world, if you want to be able to deal with our world and actually have a hope that works in this life, I'd invite you to explore the claims that Jesus makes in the gospel. And we'd love for you to do that with us. Whatever else your day holds, I trust that you and your family have a blessed and safe and merry Christmas. I invite the team up. We're going to close our service with a couple of songs, as we tend to. And for those of you who are visiting with us, there's going to be a handful of staff and whatnot down the front here. We'd love to pray. We pray every time we gather together as the people of God. If there's anything that you want prayer for, we'd love to pray for you. Safety on your travels, grace for the family luncheon that you're about to go to. Whatever it may be, we'd love to pray for you this morning if you would like that. Trust that regardless of what else happens today, that you remember the hope that we have in Christ Jesus. Thanks, Jeff.